So Tim touched on the idea of spiritual experiences last week, and this morning's talk is about one of my own. And it's a particular story that really came alive to me very profoundly. It drew me in, it spoke to me, and I really felt like it even became mine over a couple of years. And it's the story of Jacob wrestling with the angel, which, ironically enough, someone also mentioned last week, so I thought, oh, that's kind of funny. And I never like assuming that people know the context of these stories from the OT, so I'll fill you in a little bit ahead of time. The context is that Jacob, earlier in his life, had found a way to trick his father into granting him a blessing rather than his older brother. And of course, in that culture, it was the older brother that had the right to that blessing. So because of the resulting animosity, Jacob actually needed to flee for his life. He hadn't seen his brother in years, and now Jacob was in a situation where he is about to encounter his brother and all of his brother's entourage, his family, his servants. He is scared. So at this point, the text reads, "That night, Jacob got up and took his two wives, his two female servants, and his 11 sons, and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. After he had sent them across the stream, he sent over all his possessions. So Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until daybreak. When the man saw that he could not overpower him, he touched the socket of Jacob's hip, so that his hip was wrenched as he wrestled with the man. Then the man said, 'Let me go, for it is daybreak.' But Jacob replied, 'I will not let you go unless you bless me.' The man asked him, 'What is your name?' 'Jacob,' he answered. Then the man said, 'Your name will no longer be Jacob, but Israel, because you have struggled with God and with humans and have overcome.' Jacob said, 'Please tell me your name.' But he replied, 'Why do you ask my name?' Then he blessed him there. So Jacob called the place Peniel, saying, 'It is because I saw God face to face, and yet my life was spared.' The sun rose above him as he passed Peniel, and he was limping because of his hip." It was kind of strange that I connected to this story so deeply, because I generally don't even like the Old Testament that much, and I like the bizarre stories in it even less, because usually I'm not sure how to take them or integrate them into something that's relevant for me. So I was thinking at some point, maybe it was that there's a sort of dreamlike quality to this story that might have kind of drawn me in. I've long had this friendly relationship with my dreams and what they try to tell me. I'm not talking about dream interpretation where if you see a mountain, it means that you're about to have a big climb or something like that. It's, I once even started to write a song in a dream, actually, almost the whole first first verse came to me in a dream. And whether or not God speaks through my dreams or it's my brain sorting things out and making sense of our world, I don't really know. But I am glad for those times where whatever happens at night brings along the sense of moving along or insight or closure, and that these kinds of moments bring. My dreams, though, while sometimes insightful, are still really, really weird. Like, I can be walking along in my high school corridor, and then suddenly realize it's exam week, and I haven't attended a single class all semester, and then I can't get my locker open to get out any clothes, and then all of a sudden I'm realizing I'm totally naked, and then all of a sudden there's Tom Hanks. Like, this is a pretty typical thing for me. And this passage kind of has that feel. Jacob is by the stream, and then suddenly he's wrestling somebody. Oh, and then it's an angel. And then the angel wants to let go because it's day. Like, why that has anything to do with anything, who knows? And then the angel makes his hip goes out of his socket. And then Jacob decides that the angel is God. So like my dreams, it seems to have that sense of, this all seems kind of disconnected and bizarre and things like that. But nevertheless, I seem to seize onto those themes that seem to jump out at me and relate to my life, even though that scenario is kind of bizarre. And for me, there's four themes that came out of this story for me. First one, Jacob's emotional and psychological struggle became physical. In foster care, I used to work in foster care, treatment foster care, and I did home studies as part of that process. And that involves asking people all sorts of really intensive questions about their lives, present and past. I remember one particular applicant describing how as a young man, he and his buddies would regularly go to bars with the intent of getting into fights with people. And how he viewed it now as stupid and dangerous. But at the time, it got out the angst and the energy within him. And we have all heard stories, and maybe we've even found this in our own lives, that sometimes people just seem determined to pick a fight no matter how much someone tries to calm the situation down. Sometimes there's a restlessness that feels like it can only get out with physical aggression. In my 20s, I worked in a group home with children and youth, and I experienced violence there firsthand. During my 7 years, I was spit on, my hair got pulled, someone tried to kick me in the stomach when I was pregnant. My inner response was that I wanted to act out in the same way. The desire to hurt in response to being hurt was very strong. I often felt like slapping a youth who hurled curse words at me, or being rough with someone whose spit was running down my face when I needed to restrain them. Our bodies have a fight, flight, freeze response to overwhelming circumstances. And our brains are not able to respond completely rationally. The more primitive part of our brain starts taking over to either enter into conflict, run away from conflict, or just simply lose the ability to do anything. Our brains and bodies also have really interesting interactions. Our emotions can affect our physical health in the long term and vice versa. That really came home to me clearly once with something that happened with my daughter. And she literally became unable to form words. How she was talking was kind of like, I can't speak. She was like, I think 17 at the time. And I seriously wondered if she was having a stroke. So we called up our doctor. The doctor said, get her in here right now. Did a quick overview that said, you know what, send her to Children's Emergency. So we went to Children's Emergency and saw numerous doctors there, and they finally came to the conclusion that it wasn't a medical condition at all, but how her body was dealing with anxiety. And by the way, I got my daughter's permission to tell this story, and she also texted me to say, if you need more examples, I have lots because I've been dealing with anxiety for 19 years. I know at times I have been hard on myself due to just having a normal response to stress. I've expected my brain to act in a rational way, even though it's gone into crisis mode. It's important to understand that we can't be at our best when stress is overwhelming, and we can't think as clearly when we are in crisis. We are literally more stupid when we are under stress. And out of that, I think what we can take is that we need to have grace for ourselves. We need to have care for ourselves, and we need to do the same thing for each other, grace and care, so that that will meet the stress that we feel. The second theme I get out of this, Jacob, in the midst of dealing with a crisis of fear for his own safety, ends up wrestling with God. And I think this is our reality too, that when we have crises in our lives, it ends up bringing on existential crises too. We start to question God, we start to question our purpose, and we start to question the meaning of our lives. A former coworker of mine, when we were working together, was going through a really rocky marriage. Her husband was from a significantly different culture from her, which really added to that. At the same time, her child, also a teenage girl for that matter, was having major health challenges and no medical explanation whatsoever. At some point, she actually wondered if her kid might be dying. She was talking to me one day about just her perspective on life, her challenges, and everything like that. And she said, I used to think that I would work to get past my problems and issues, and then one day I realized that never happens. You never reach that point. There will always be more problems and issues. I remember feeling that former way in my 20s. I thought my task was to get past my dysfunctional childhood stuff, and then ta-da! Smooth sailing after that. I never reached that point. Like Jacob, I have also had my times of going down to the water, sometimes literally finding myself on the banks of a river or lake, and pouring my heart out to God, asking, why does it work this way? Why does there have to be so much pain and frustration? And why things don't go the way I want them to? I honestly don't have any better answers to questions that have plagued theologians and philosophers for centuries. So sorry if that's what you were hoping for. But one thing I have found is that I can sometimes come into these times with the assumption that things should be different. I don't know why I feel like my life should go smoothly or why I have this sense of deservedness about myself, but I do. And over time, I found it helpful to just simply accept the fact that this is the stuff of life. I've learned to see God as an ally in the suffering rather than expecting him to be the deliverer for me from the suffering. And with that perspective, honestly, it does get a bit easier. I think I'm doing better at 50 than I was at 20. I don't end up adding to my own pain and angst. I wrestle less and I rest more. Third theme that jumps up to me here is that Jacob doesn't let go until he gets God's blessing. I'm hanging on until you bless me. He really knew his desperation, and he was well aware of his chances when his brothers and his brother's crew showed up the next day. The only thing for him to do was to recognize that without a blessing, a divine gift, he was truly screwed. A time of my life when I reckoned with my need for God's blessing was, again, in my 20s, very anxious, when I was wrestling with my view of women in the church. The theological view that was handed to me from my upbringing was one of complementarianism, meaning that women and men have complementary but different roles in God's design. In practical terms, what that meant for the church I grew up in, as well as Bible school I attended and everything like that, was that women's roles were a lot more restrictive. And that never sat right with me from little time on. So it was no surprise that I explored alternative views once I hit adulthood. And it was no surprise as well that that made a lot of people around me uncomfortable. Someone soon handed me a book that claimed to be about biblical manhood and womanhood. You know where this is going, don't you? I don't think I ever finished reading that book. At some point, it was thrown across the living room. And I remember saying to God that if this is what it meant to be a Christian, then I wasn't sure I wanted to be one. The sense that I had in my head at that moment was, if that's how God wants it though, would I be willing to hang on to God and let God work on me until I could be accepting of that? Like I said before, I don't know when things come into my head or God talking or just my own thoughts, but I do know I'm really thankful for that moment. While my presence here at this church, the fact that I've made that home, probably makes it clear to you that I have come to an egalitarian view of the sexes, I think a me who believes in the equality of women and has God at the center of things looks very different from a me that believes in the equality of women but has me at the center of things. A difference as to my attitudes, my decisions, who is included, and whether love plays the role it was meant to. That can be said for any ism and any issue. When it stays all about me, when it's allowed to revolve around myself and my anger and my fear, people are excluded, left out, and mocked. Someone else ends up being oppressed. Someone ends up being unloved, and progress is stifled. So even though I embraced a view of women's equality, which is my preferred view, the idea that I need to seek out God's view of things, even if it's difficult, has been important to me. Because there are other things I read and believe that really aren't my preferences. Things like turning the other cheek, if someone wants to take your tunic, give him your cloak as well, take up your cross and follow me, whoever loses their lives for my sake will find it, and one of my favorites, forgive someone 70 times 7. What ticks me off about this one especially is that I'm sure by now some people in my life must have reached that 490, but I don't know, because I haven't been keeping track. So I think from now on what I need to do is like have a spreadsheet on my computer with everybody's names and how many times they've sinned against me with the dates and the context and things like that. And of course, I am kidding. I'm not going to make a spreadsheet about all of this. It's 2019. If anything, I'm going to use an app on my smartphone. The idea about placing God's desires for us centrally, though, came back to me in a podcast I listened to recently. It was an interview with a guy named Jeff Chu. And he wrote a book about his experiences, or not so much his experiences, although it's, I think that entered into it, experience of being gay and Christian in America. He wanted to interview people that represented a full range of viewpoints on the issue. So who represents some of the most rigid and angry theological views on the subject? You know this. Westboro Baptist. He went and spent time with Westboro Baptist Church as a gay Christian. His reflections on this time, when I heard them, really struck me. And I'm going to read right from the transcript. So the thing for me about Westboro, that whole trip was really transformed on the Sunday when we went out picketing. And it was a super hot day, and we're standing on a street corner, and there was a six-year-old boy named Ben. Ben couldn't read the words on the sign he was holding. He's standing at the roadside with a sign that's preaching at people driving by on their way to church on Sunday morning, and he can't read those words. And I thought, what kind of accountability should he have for that? And I couldn't. I was just sad. He was this adorable kid who loves jumping on a trampoline in the backyard and was scared about going to public school for the first time, just like any normal six-year-old would be. And the question I left with, and the question I have mulled over many times over the years is, at what age am I allowed to hate Ben? Does it happen when he's 13 and going through puberty? And then I'm like, okay, now I can hate you. Now I can be angry with you. Now I'm allowed to not extend grace to you. Or is it when he's 18 or 21? How does that work? And I couldn't ever figure out a moment at which my own faith or my understanding of God's love would let me off the hook. If we are taking the idea of following Jesus seriously, it's not going to be easy because Jesus asks for us to look at our own hearts and be the person who becomes transformed. And sometimes I don't feel I can do that, what I'm being asked to do, without saying, I'm not letting go until you bless me. I need God's blessing in order to face crises. I need divine blessing in order to walk up my life in accordance with the values I've come to believe God wants me to have in my life. Sometimes when I hear people's stories of feeling disappointed by God and subsequently rejecting him, sometimes they still believe in him and just refuse to just have much to do with God, but sometimes they abandon belief altogether. And sometimes there's a point of crisis, a point at where they give an ultimatum to God, like, show me, do as I ask, or I'm going to walk away. An option to consider is being willing to hang on until the blessing comes, accepting the process and the timing, and not demanding our own way. The fourth theme that really jumps out to me from this one is Jacob walked away with a limp. I have friends by the name of Cindy and Doug, and I got to know them when they were married a few years. Me and my then husband were just in the process of going out and then getting engaged. And so we were all in our early 20s, and Cindy and Doug at that point in time really wanted to have a child, and they tried and they tried, and nothing ever happened. Cindy had all sorts of tests done, and while they discovered some small amount of endometriosis, they were going, like, this should not have prevented you from getting pregnant. Within a year or two, I do remember, Cindy did become pregnant, and like we in the church were just thrilled for them, and she miscarried. Eventually, they did a private adoption of an infant, and then about 2 years later, they were able to adopt their son's biological half-brother, who had come into CFS care by that time. Then, a few years after that, they had another chance at a private adoption through connections. A friend of theirs had a granddaughter who was saying, I'm pregnant, I want to release for adoption. So they began the whole process to welcome a third child into their family. And months down the road, they discovered that the birth mother wasn't actually pregnant. Their oldest son has not had normal development. He's been diagnosed both with FASD and autism. And I used to work in the FASD field after I became a social worker. And so I've known a lot of kids with FASD. And his problems are about the most severe I have witnessed for any kid. His brain seems to lack empathy or the ability to observe social norms. He is driven to want what he wants in the moment all the time, regardless of the cost to others. The stress on them has been enormous. Their son has been in residential care and psychiatric hospitals, and for a time they even lived in separate cities because the care, the hospital that could receive their son was in Edmonton. They lived in Calgary, so Doug would live in Edmonton during the week and then come back home to Calgary on the weekends. Both have needed medication to cope sometimes. Cindy hates the saying, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And she says, sometimes what doesn't kill you can hurt you and make you weaker. I feel like our North American culture emphasizes that we win and that we overcome. We overcome our adversities, our problems, our issues, and our diseases. And these are stories that even get trumpeted to us from a very early age. An author by the name of Pamela Drucker wrote a book called Bringing Up, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right, bébé? It's a French word for baby. And it's French because she is an American living in Paris. The book is about the differences that she sees in parenting in North America as opposed to France. And she noted that in American children's stories, the general arc was this. Character has a problem, you find a solution, you solve the problem. In her daughter's favorite French story, the character had a problem, tried to fix it, and the problem kept happening anyways. There was no resolution. And I don't come across many stories with that kind of arc. In children's literature I've come across, they've usually followed the typical American pattern. We're here to solve problems. When we don't win, when things don't work out, the tendency is to try to figure out who is to blame. And that was true for ancient cultures as well. That's why in the story in John 9, where Jesus and his disciples see a blind man, the disciples ask right away, whose sin caused this man to be born blind? Because obviously someone has to be at fault, right? And I don't think our current religious culture fares much better, because most of us are probably familiar with at least one story of somebody who was told that they were not healed or did not have something they wanted because they did not have enough faith. I also don't think it's just a religious thing. When people have struggles in their lives with things such as gambling, substance abuse, weight issues, we have thousands of voices that deride them for their lack of willpower and how they should just not go into the casino, not shoot up, and not eat so much. We want to hear the stories about people who overcame cancer and went on to win the Tour de France, not people who don't overcome. But, quite frankly, the circumstances of life don't make winners for us all. Sometimes, like Cindy and Doug's son, our circumstances before birth can put us at a disadvantage. And sometimes what happens to us after we're born can affect us in really profound ways. In my hometown, in Saskatchewan, I once had a conversation with a mom whose family farm, we grew up really near each other, like their family farm is a mile away from ours, and in family farm terms, they were the next closest neighbors to us. So I grew up with their kids on the school bus together and things like that. They were part of our same church. They were a really interesting family because they had adopted four kids anywhere from infancy to teenage years, in addition to having two biological kids on their own. And in the course of our conversation, I was telling her about a book I had been reading, which is called From Neurons to Neighborhoods, The Science of Early Childhood Development, which basically summarizes all the research out there on early childhood development. And one of the things that's said in the beginning of that book is what happens during the first months and years of life matters a lot, not because this period of development provides an indelible blueprint for adult well-being, but because it sets either a sturdy or fragile stage for what follows. The mom got tears in her eyes and said she had never heard anyone describe her kids so well. My own early years, I can't say were full of abuse or neglect, but I have recognized that there are things I carry in me which aren't easily altered. As a social worker, I get to learn about human nature and human development as part of my education and training. That helps me not only to understand my own clients, but to understand myself a lot more. And one of the areas I've had a fair amount of training in is that of attachment, how our earliest experiences affect our relationships with caregivers, but also beyond that. That can affect our relationships like throughout even our adult years. And I'm a person with some insecure attachment patterns. It's good for me to have that knowledge because I can recognize my patterns and make choices to do things differently than I might feel compelled to do. I remember there's been lots of occasions in my parenting where what I felt like doing because of my attachment is when my kids are in crisis to just get out of there. ignore them, not have anything to do with them. My mind can kick in, it can say, your kid needs you right now, whether or not you feel like being there. But despite that knowledge, I still react out of my early attachment patterns sometimes. In crisis, my instinct, my first response is to act out of that avoidant place, to not trust that people will actually care for me, and not believing that I matter. The knowledge that I've learned doesn't change the fact that I walk with a limp. And there's lots of different circumstances that bring limp into our lives, whether we are born, the circumstances we're born with, our early childhood experiences, later illnesses, traumas, crises that bring profound and lasting changes. And like Jacob, sometimes even these are things that our own actions bring into our lives. I'm not discounting that out of bad experiences we can learn and grow, nor am I doing away with the idea of Romans 8:28 that God can use things for good. But what I'm saying is that sometimes because of what happens in our lives, we're not the same. The change that takes place is not positive, and this can be our reality. I don't think God is in the business of going around zapping people's hips while physically wrestling them on riverbanks, but I am glad there was a place for a story where someone could meet with God, he could be blessed by God, and he could still walk away with a limp without it being his fault. It seems to me that's important, because in the situations in which I have walked away with a limp, and sometimes I'm still walking with a limp, I need to know that I can be part of the story with God, I can be part of God's blessing, and I can still have a limp as part of my reality. So when this story became my story, the themes coming out of it were things I really needed to be aware of as I walked through some really difficult circumstances, which most of you are aware of for the last few years of my life. But I also think these are ideas that we can all stand to be reminded about, which is why I decided to share it with you this morning. That we are people whose physical selves are greatly impacted by our emotional circumstances, and we need to have grace for that. That during times of crisis, we naturally flow into wrestling with God, and that's okay. That we can respond to these times by knowing that we need God's blessing and seeking it, and that it's okay if we end up walking away with a limp, because we're still part of the story. Thanks for hearing me out this morning.